You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
And I have to say, at both CSIS and Georgetown, the audiences are nowhere near this disciplined. It usually takes an effort for the moderator to get everybody to be quiet. So it shows both the good discipline and order at Brookings, but also the great interest in this wonderful new volume produced by my good friends Jim Steinberg and Mike O'Hanlon. I hope you have all picked up a copy out front and bought some for Mother's Day and Thanksgiving and Christmas. Strategic reassurance and resolve. I'm going to ask Jim and Mike some questions about the book, and then we'll open it up. I've read this in several versions, I think, and it's a very powerful volume. It's very timely. There's nothing quite like it that dissects the challenges of managing relations with a rising power, looking at military and other dimensions, and thinking through logically where all this goes. It's the kind of work that I would expect from Jim and Mike, whom I've known for a long time. My association with Mike O'Hanlon goes back to the 1930s, when our mothers were best friends in Riverhead, Long Island, and I've known Jim not quite that long. So let me open up first with Jim and ask, other than the fact that you have a lot of time now, why the book? There's a certain urgency to it. Maybe you could open by telling the audience the central argument and why you thought it had to be written and written in this way right now.
Thanks, Mike. First of all, it's great to be back at Brookings and find our familiar and old faces that I'm delighted to see again. I think the motivation for the book is, for me, and I think shared with Mike, is this sort of quite interesting conundrum about U.S.-China relations. On the one hand, because of the depth and the extent of the ties between our two countries, the interdependence, there's this sense that conflict between the two countries is unimaginable. And yet, when we look both at contemporary events and all the places where there's a lot of tension and contention, and the broader international relations historical narrative about the challenge of managing the relationships between established powers and rising powers, from that lens, it looks like conflict is almost inevitable. And so you have this conundrum in which it seems unimaginable. Certainly everybody would appear to be losers if it were to happen. And yet history tells us, and recent events suggest, that maybe it's not so unthinkable. And so the fundamental challenge and the fundamental motivation is the huge cost that would come about from conflict, and yet the realization that if not handled well, conflict is quite possible. And so that really is the motivation behind the book, is to try to find a way at least to reduce the chances that a relationship which shouldn't turn sour might go very, very bad. And I think the insight comes from something that you understand well, having been involved for so long, both from the specifics of the relationships in East Asia and the broader problem of rising and established powers, is that even under the best of circumstances where both sides see the value of cooperation, there are structural reasons why it's hard to achieve. And those structural reasons are related to the fundamental uncertainty and, in the end, unknowability about the intentions of the other side. We've heard a lot in recent years about building strategic trust between the United States and China and building a new model of great power relations. But the truth is that and for good reason, however the sincerity or the power of the words that each side profess about the desire to build that trust, they have to have doubts because there are certain parts of their relationship which are fundamentally uncertain. First, even when each side professes good intentions, you can't really know enough about the inner workings of each government to know for sure what they're all about. But even more important, even if you had a lot of confidence, even if you had two leaders who really looked into each other's soul and saw each other's intentions, you don't know what the future holds. You don't know what the next generation will hold. And so what happens in situations like this, particularly when you have a rising power with increasing capabilities, is that there's a tendency to worry what might happen in the future and to hedge against that worry. And we all know that the problem with hedging is that when one side hedges, just as a kind of a prudent precaution, the other side sees that hedge as potentially threatening. And so each side, acting rationally, trying to understand and deal with the uncertainties of the future, begin to hope for the best but prepare for the worst and create doubts and uncertainty in each other's minds. That sets up a very powerful and dangerous dynamic, which can lead to conflict. And this is very powerful in the case of the United States and China because of the differences between our two systems, the uncertainties that that creates in our understanding of each other, and the growing capability of China, both its capacity because of its economic growth and its direct capabilities because of its military modernization. So the IR community has tended to see these through two different kinds of lenses. One, a very pessimistic lens. Conflict is inevitable. It's the tragedy of great powers. Get ready for it. And the others who say, well, interdependence will protect us even though there are all these forces for conflict. And our conviction is that the worst is not certain, but the best is not foreordained either. And so the question is, how do you manage that? And what can both sides do when they can never be sure what the other's intentions are, but each knows that they'd be better off if they cooperate? That's the basic premise. And we argue that there are two very fundamental principles that have to be addressed here. One, reassurance, which is an attempt to try to dispel misplaced anxieties, you know, situations where one side fears that the other has hostile or not friendly intentions, and how do you dispel that misplaced anxiety? But also, which is one source of conflict, but also to deal with the case where sides misjudge where the other really does have an intention to act and makes a misjudgment about their resolve. And so both of these poles of our argument, reassurance and resolve, are basically trying to dispel uncertainty, create more clarity about intentions, and allow each other to make the adjustments they need to manage the relationship. What's important to understand about the argument is it doesn't assume goodwill on either side. It doesn't assume bad will either. It just says we can't know for sure, and how would we manage these relationships to get a positive and more cooperative outcome given the fundamental uncertainty about both near and long-term intentions?
How do you do it, Mike?
First, let me thank you and thank my co-author most of all. This, as you can imagine, it's an amazing treat to write a book with one of the brightest guys in the field who just came off 2.5 years of working this problem day in and day out, as I know you have in the past. And very quickly, before I get to your question, I want to thank a few others, Ian Livingston, Andrea Baldwin, colleagues at the Brookings China Center, East Asia Center, a lot of people who have helped us, including our book launch in a week in East Asia, which will include stops, for example, in the Beijing office of Brookings. So thanks to many, and thanks to all of you for being here. How do we do it? Well, you've lived this and worked this, both of you. I'm just going to give a couple examples, and I'm going to pick up on the word hedging, because there are a lot of ways to go at the question you pose. But historically, we thought of hedging as just prudence, right? You hope you can build a good relationship, but you have a just-in-case policy. And nobody can be against that in the abstract. The problem is that hedging can mean a lot of things in a lot of contexts to a lot of people. And one of the things it could mean, hypothetically, is, okay, we see China now solidly established as the world's number two military power, at least in spending terms, close to $200 billion a year. The U.S. is still way ahead at $600 billion a year. Our allies add another $400 billion. So the Western alliance vis-a-vis China is still sort of a trillion to $200 billion. But the gap's closing. And one possible American response would be to say, we don't want that gap to get any closer. We don't want it to close. We don't want to lose this ratio. And so we're going to embark on a new military buildup. Now, I'm against sequestration, and I actually think we do need to increase spending a bit above and beyond where it currently is under the Murray-Ryan plan. That's the level of technical and budgetary detail that I'm not even necessarily asking my co-author to agree with, because, you know, we can debate about military budget specifics. My point is I am concerned that the United States maintain its resoluteness and its capability and not concede superiority. But at the same time, if we try to hold on to the advantage that we've had historically at the level we've had it, it's not going to work. So if we interpret hedging to mean just outcompete the Chinese the way that Ronald Reagan outcompeted the Soviets in many people's minds in the 1980s, the Chinese economy is fundamentally much healthier. So that model is not going to be as easily applicable. For the Chinese, however, they're going to have to also recognize if we just try to become an equal to the Americans, first of all, we have a long ways to go. Second, they've got some pretty good allies. They've got, as Jim and I calculate in the book, $3 trillion worth of cumulative weapons inventory of modern stuff. The Chinese have probably less than $200 billion. So it's like a 15-to-1 American advantage by the accumulated investment. And so if their strategy of hedging is, well, let's try to approach parity with America because that's the only way that we can be sure this is all going to work out for us, that's not a very good formula either. So we're left with a world in which we're arguing for both sides to show some restraint in their degree of military buildup. Of course, right now the Americans are not, we're not building up, we're building down. And so on this one, for the United States, and I'll just give you one recommendation here, our idea is not to say the United States should cut its budget to somehow approach China's, but to say that our big new idea of modernization, air-sea battle, which has some good military ideas behind it, needs to be modified because the Chinese hear it as confrontational. They hear it as code for containment, and it's evocative of air-land battle doctrine, which NATO had against the Soviets in the Cold War. We say it's not directed against China. They think that it is, and some of it's militarily logical and necessary, but we need to modify it. And there are a couple of ways we suggest doing so in the book, starting with the name, air-sea operations, also trying to include allies and even the Chinese in certain aspects of air-sea operations where we can. So that's one way in which we can sort of try to show some desire for cooperative relations without conceding military superiority. One last quick point, and I'm sorry to go on, but just as you know, it's a complex set of questions. For the Chinese, I don't know how this is going to be received when we talk about it, when I talk about it next week in Beijing and Shanghai, but we suggest to them that now that they're getting within about, you know, $400 billion of the annual U.S. budget in military matters, that they think about slowing down their buildup a little pretty soon. And that may sound funny to say, but the argument is China depends on the American military to protect Persian Gulf oil, on which it depends, and therefore China has a certain stake in this U.S.-led international order. We know that over time they want to modify it in some sense to allow themselves a greater role, but they also need to show some acknowledgement that it serves their interests and they're not seeking to overturn it. So even though I can't put it in very precise language, as they start to approach half of our military budget in the coming years, they might want to think about just slowing down the buildup because there's a certain logic to their being roughly half as strong as us for at least a certain short period of time. We're protecting the Persian Gulf and the Middle East. They're not. It's to their benefit that we are. And so there's a logic to recognizing that this is a moment where perhaps a slowdown might be in order in the coming years. So as you can see, we can give a lot more recommendations from the book that are more precise, that get into very specific arms control or military domains. This is a broader one, but I think it captures some of the spirit of what I want to give as an answer to your question.
Thanks. Yeah, the thing I'd just add is that I think part of what we try to do in the book is to get at the question of how do you give credibility to this idea that each side wants to develop a cooperative relationship or at least avoid this problem of arms racing and crisis instability. We each profess to each other that we have good intentions, but I was very much struck a year ago when I was at Shangri-La, the annual meeting of the East Asian defense ministers, that Secretary Hale gave a very compelling explanation of the pivot, the rebalance, and why this was designed to enhance stability for all, was not designed to contain China, et cetera, et cetera. And a major general in the PLA stood up, and she said, Mr. Secretary, we hear you, but we are not convinced. And similarly, when the Chinese speak of peaceful rise and the like, many voices here in the United States say, we're not convinced. We see what's going on. We see your military modernization. We see the activity in the East China Sea. We're not convinced. You say these things. So the question is, what is it that concretely that each side can do that both gives credibility to the fact that they don't have these hostile intentions and, equally important, are observable enough that if they begin to deviate from them and start to do things that are, in fact, threatening, that we'll see them soon enough, we can react in time so that we don't jeopardize our own security on either side, but we don't have to prematurely assume the worst by preparing that before it emerges. And it's that idea of trying to find concrete steps, which we focus on restraint, as Mike said. What can each side, cases where sides might do something but choose not to do them, is a good sign. It's not absolutely certain, but it's a positive sign about intentions. So, for example, one of the things we talk about, which has been more successful in U.S.-China relations, is in the nuclear field. One of the things that's notable is that over the past now 50 years, about since China first acquired nuclear weapons, that they have not sought parity with the United States. And though there's some debate about where they're going, there's still no sign that they're trying to equal the U.S. nuclear force structure. That's restraint, and that itself is a very positive step. and relatively observable from the outside. Similarly, although we are out of the ABM Treaty and have been out of the ABM Treaty for over a decade, we haven't sought to build a missile defense architecture that's designed to degrade the Chinese nuclear capability. That's restraint on our side. We could do it. Wouldn't be perfect, but we could certainly complicate the Chinese situation a lot. But we've recognized that there's little reason to do it, and there's a danger that we would simply induce them into an offense-defense arms race. So even though we're not constrained either by technology, money, or by arms control agreements, we have exercised restraint. These are the kinds of tools that we try to identify across all of these different areas of U.S.-China relations.
Thank you. You mentioned, Jim, that you're not relying on interdependence and you're not assuming that conflict's inevitable. And in the pre-war period, in the 1920s and 30s, everyone knows about Norman Angell before World War I, but before World War II, Thomas Lamont of J.P. Morgan gave a speech in Los Angeles in 1928 saying war with Japan is absolutely unthinkable because of economic interdependence, which was considerable. Others, Earl Ellis, this wild Marine, and others were saying war is absolutely inevitable, and you're trying to explore that space in between. But I want to try to do two things. First,
By the way, can I just interject? We'll be back soon when Mike Green's excellent book on the history of this relationship and U.S. involvement in East Asia will be out, and I have been privileged to see early drafts of this. You'll be very excited by it.
Thank you. But don't hold your breath. I'm just getting to the end of the Cold War. So I want to ask a few questions about the assumptions, the large strategic and theoretical assumptions, and then a little bit about the specific recommendations. Because very handily, this is a great piece of scholarship and a great piece of think tank work, because on page 209 is an appendix with the recommendations listed in bullet form in good Brookings style. So I'll get to those in a minute. But first the assumptions. Try to identify what this strategy is and isn't. So when you go to the Pentagon and you walk down the policy wing, as you both know, they have in big letters reassure, dissuade, deter, defeat. The idea being that stability depends on reassurance, which you focus on a lot here, but ultimately the ability to defeat aggression. So as you look at how to manage the security dilemma created by hedging, are you saying we no longer need to be able to defeat Chinese aggression against Taiwan, Japan, other U.S. interests militarily, or we just need to explain it or shape it better?
Not at all. Indeed, the reason why there are two nouns in the book is because it requires both reassurance and resolve. Reassurance, as I said, to dispel misplaced anxieties. But resolve is to make clear where the red lines are and where actions will produce responses. That's the deterrence part. I would qualify the deterrence thing. I'm not sure it's defeat per se. It's to raise enough uncertainty in the mind of the person, the other side, that they would pay a cost that they don't want to pay to dissuade them from acting. So I think, but it is certainly, and that's why it's so important to have clarity about the resolve, to let each side know what each side considers worth fighting for. And that's partially a statement of intentions, but again, which we stress so much in the book, it's much more about capabilities, because intentions can be stated but still leave ambiguity because it's not clear whether the intentions are meant. And so what we focus on is what kinds of capabilities do you need to do? And what's particularly, I think, powerful right now in thinking about this is to be effective in deterrence, it has to be credible that you both have the capabilities and you will use them. And the danger in the U.S.-China relationship right now is because so much is at stake, there's a danger that each side will misjudge the other's willingness to go to war, to oversimplify, over the issue, simply because the danger of those wars and the potential cost of those wars are so high. So deterrence might fail if each side believes that the only response to crossing a red line is all-out war. And so one of the things that we emphasize in the book is to develop a set of tools that make deterrence credible, that gives you an option short of attacking each other's homeland to respond to actions that cross red lines. And I think that's where the credibility of deterrence comes, is to have a toolkit which allows you to impose a cost on the other side without making it the equivalent of a Cold War all-out nuclear exchange.
Mike, let me push you on this one a little bit, because this could be interpreted, I'll give you a chance to correct my thick
added interpretation, but it could be interpreted as moving away from what has been a sort of unspoken, at least publicly unspoken, element of U.S. strategy in the Pacific for longer than you and I have been around, which is that we will defeat any aggression against the first island chain and since the Korean War against Korea. So is this in any way a diminution of defeat? For example, you take some issue with air-sea battle and propose air-sea operations, but air-sea battle, joint operational access, JOAC, I mean, all of that is trying to maintain, thinking of ways to maintain an edge so that the other side doesn't assume that we cannot defeat aggression. So where do you draw that line, or are you moving the line a little bit in the name of reassurance?
I don't think the line
or budget realities.
I don't think we're moving the line. I think technology and the rise of China are changing the structure of the competition, and there are elements of real competition, as we all know, in this relationship. Or to put it a different way, it's gotten harder to defend the first island chain. And rather than pull back from the first island chain, what I would submit is we need to make our forward bases resilient, in some cases redundant. Doesn't mean we need to open new bases yet in other countries. We would hold that in reserve, in a sense, in response to possible Chinese provocation if our strategy doesn't work or isn't accepted and implemented by both sides. But I think it's gotten to be a much more difficult proposition to think of the Western Pacific as essentially an American lake the way that it had been for decades, at least in the U.S.-China context. That's going to get harder, and no policy argument from CSIS or AEI or Brookings or anywhere else can change the fact.
Now speak for yourself.
That the Chinese now do have a lot more weapons to threaten carriers, fixed land bases, and other such things. One interpretation of air-sea battle, and by the way, we go out of our way to say to praise the parts of air-sea battle logic that we agree with in the book, and. You know, a lot of the need to improve our defenses, improve our resilience, improve our hardening, those are absolutely correct. But the notion of some advocates of air-sea battle, which is to pull back from a lot of our dependence on forward bases, I don't want to put words in Jim's mouth, but I don't necessarily agree with that, because what that suggests is disengagement from your allies. There may be some kind of a narrow military logic that says you're better off flying a lot of bombers from Guam than you, or Hawaii or California than you are having forward tactical air in Japan or elsewhere. I think you need a mix, partly because you've got to show that you're as committed to your allies as you ever were. And so I don't want to over-respond at a technical level to military trends by pulling back, making ourselves feel like we're defensible, but all of a sudden raising questions about our commitment to our traditional allies.
Let me just, because I think I focusing on the specifics is probably an easier way to get at answering your question. So it's definitely not pulling back from the commitments, but it is making deterrence more credible. The problem with some aspects of air-sea battle is that it implies, or at least suggests, that in order to prevail, we need to move early on in a crisis to attacking the Chinese homeland. The capabilities are structured, they're offensive-minded, and they're designed to, in effect, take it to the enemy. That has a superficial attraction, except for the fact that the other side gets a voice, too. And if they see in a crisis that you're prepared to strike early and preemptively against their strategic assets in their homeland, it will lead them to act early and preemptively by disabling our satellites, by taking cyber attacks against our capabilities. Each side, fearing that the other is going to go preemptively and offensively, then moves the timeline back and creates enormous instability even in a small conflict. And so what we advocate is an approach that gives you more tools, not to undermine deterrence, but to strengthen deterrence, because you're much more credible to say, in the event, say, of some kind of Chinese action directed at Taiwan, a blockade, or even a direct attack, that we have options short of attacking Beijing or attacking their nuclear forces early on in the conflict. That's why I focused, when talking about deterrence, on imposing a cost. It's not just winning the war. It's making the other side feel that you have the ability to impose costs. They can be economic, they can be military, they can be a range of costs that will dissuade them from starting the adventure in the first place. That's what creates stability, rather than a situation where each side is in effect on a hair trigger. We learned that lesson in the Cold War. And one of the things you'll see in this book, I know you know, is although most of our friends, especially in China, don't like drawing lessons from the Cold War dynamic between the United States and Soviet Union, and there are many important differences between the relationship, between China and the Soviet Union. The truth is we had to deal with many of these kinds of challenges in managing U.S.-Soviet relations. And we learned that there are things that we could do to stabilize the competition, which didn't weaken deterrence, which didn't weaken our ability to meet our fundamental commitments, but made it less likely that we would get into a crisis and be forced to escalate, be forced to take measures which could benefit neither side.
We may come back to this, but let me turn to another assumption that's in the book, which is what are the drivers of Chinese behavior? On the one hand, you have Ian Johnston, Taylor Favelle arguing that what China's engaging in is reactive assertiveness, that essentially it's a classic Thucydidean trap, and they're reacting to us, reacting to them, reacting to, sounds like a bad episode of The Honeymooners. On the other hand, you have Aaron Friedberg and others arguing, no, there's strategic intent here. This is a long-term Chinese ambition to push out their security perimeter. It's a natural thing in a way. It's what all rising powers, including ourselves, do. I read one, I'm convinced. I read the other, I'm convinced. Where do you come out on the determinants or the drivers for Chinese strategy? Because, you know, the answer to this question of how much hedge, how much deterrence is going to depend on that.
See, I think that's the wrong question, Mike, to be honest. I think that the premise of the book is that we can't know with enough confidence to base a good policy based on that. I mean, I admire our colleagues for doing it. It's important to try to think how Chinese leaders might think about it. But I think it's a mistake for American policymakers to bet one way or the other. We have to be agnostic about this because we can't in the end know. Not simply because we can't know what this generation of Chinese leaders will do, but we can't know what Chinese leaders will do in 20 or 30 years. And that's what we have to prepare for now. All the decisions we're making are not for just today, but for 20 or 30 years from now. And so I think the power of the argument we've made, and certainly what motivated us to structure this way, is to it allows us to be agnostic on the question. We talk about why these various factors might influence them. But this is a strategy and approach where each side doesn't have to make a bet or make a judgment about what the deep strategy is of the other side. Because, I mean, one of the things we know from a lot of the work that's been done in the history is it can change over time. Strategic culture is not fixed in one place. Even if you thought at an earlier time, as some Chinese writers would say, that during the Ming Dynasty it was a very, you know, benevolent and non-aggressive, it doesn't really matter that much because although those things might shape current and future policy, they don't determine them. And so it really, I think for both of us, the core was to try to take away an assumption, to not depend on an assumption about the strategic culture or the constraints on what strategy might be, but rather to try to devise an approach which would work for the United States across a range of possibilities. And similarly for the Chinese. I mean, if you were Chinese and you were thinking, gee, they have elections in this country, presidents change, philosophies change. You want China to have a strategy that is also somewhat immune to the changes that we take place here. If you can find an approach that doesn't force a heroic assumption about where the source of the intentions are, I think you have a more resilient policy.
If I could add, very well said, and of course I agree, but one more piece to our approach is to say both sides will watch the other, and their reactions and their future policy decisions will be in part a function of what they see the other side do. So we're not suggesting that the policy could be devised once and for all on the American side to be independent of anything China may do in the coming years. So, for example, if China were to be more assertive, by our logic, this would increase the appeal of developing more American military bases in different parts of the region. But we would rather hold that sort of an option a little bit in reserve and try to induce a more virtuous cycle of behavior. So there's an element of resilience and immunity from the other side's behavior you're trying to preserve or create, but you're also watching and you're looking for this virtuous cycle. So I get back to the earlier point about air-sea battle versus the pace of Chinese military modernization. Those two areas of possible restraint on each side, we would hope both sides would make it easier for the other by creating a pattern of behavior that reinforces that trend. And in some cases, if I could just add one very specific suggestion, or one of the policy proposals we put in the book, in some cases you look for relatively harmless ways to build up a higher level of, you know, confidence. That's a big word. Trust is an even bigger word. We don't necessarily think you can create U.S.-China trust, but you look for patterns of behavior that can be mutually reinforcing. And so one very concrete idea. We all know that our friend Zbigniew Brzezinski is upset about the amount of American forward reconnaissance that's done near Chinese shores. And his recommendation, from a very strong tradition of academic and government service throughout his long career, is to say we should do less of it. Well, in our book, we don't say we should do less of it. We don't say the United States can forego reconnaissance. But we're looking for a way to make the Chinese feel a little better about the way in which we can get right up to their shores, but they can't really see very much of what happens here. So one minor, maybe modest suggestion is let's have an open skies treaty with China. As you may recall, the open skies treaty is something that the Cold War produced between NATO and the Warsaw Pact. You file a flight plan. You get to fly over another country's territory. You can see how many tanks they have parked out on one of their training grounds or how many airplanes have come out of their big aircraft production facility. There's a certain amount of limited transparency that's fostered and improved, but you don't give away any state secrets because the plan is pre-filed in advance. So that's not going to solve any problems in the relationship permanently, but if you couple some of those small measures to try to create more of a virtuous cycle with some, you know, strategies of resilience, we think you can create a virtuous dynamic that reinforces.
Just to elaborate a bit on this, I mean, in the best of all cases, you create this virtuous cycle in which each side takes steps, they're reciprocated by the other side, not necessarily negotiated, by the way, although we talk about formal arms control agreement. We don't put a lot of emphasis there because I think the history has shown that we've reached the point where often these arms control negotiations are more damaging to the relationship than helping. But so in the best case, you get reciprocal and virtuous cycles through reciprocal action. But if I could use a technical IR term here, if not, you can smoke the other guy out. I mean, the unwillingness to reciprocate, the unwillingness to exercise restraint is something that would allow you to draw some conclusions. And so part of what we envision is quite an explicit conversation between the two sides that sounds like something which we all recognize from our families. When you do this, it makes us unhappy, right? Why are you doing this? Are there other things that you could do to protect your security? So one thing we focus a lot on is on space. Right, and we see a number of things that China is doing now, ASAT testing, collisions, and the like, which worries us a lot. One, because of the collateral downside of the debris and all that, but also questions about whether this is creating deep crisis instability. As they threaten our satellites, we will have to act preemptively to take out their capability to threaten the satellites, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the things that we envision is a situation where we identify these actions, these capability developments, on the Chinese side, and we say, look, you're entitled to your legitimate degree of security, but this is a very destabilizing thing that you're doing and will require us to take some countermeasures. Are there other ways that you could achieve your goals short of doing this? And similarly, because this is obviously reciprocal, there would be an opportunity for the Chinese side to raise issues like the reconnaissance that Mike talked about to say, look, this seems very threatening to us. You're right off our shores, et cetera, et cetera. If through that dialogue we can identify reassurance steps that each side can take without undermining our own security. This is not being nice. This is not doing it as a favor to the other side. It's not weakening your own capability. It's simply identifying whether there's a path forward in which each side can protect their own legitimate security concerns in ways that are less threatening to the other.
So a number of your recommendations and your comments just now focus on confidence-building measures and transparency. And the pattern to date with the PLA has been mixed at best, because as you both know well, the PLA views transparency as a tool of the strong. This sounds good, but how do you convince them to get on board with a range of recommendations that focus on mutual transparency? For example, capping defense spending would require, one would think, some form of verification. Your recommendation on open skies and so forth would require a level of verification that would be revolutionary for the Air Force and the Navy here, but super revolutionary in the history or context of PLA thinking about transparency. So how do you convince the PLA specifically? You might have luck with the foreign ministry, but how do you convince the PLA specifically that transparency is in its interests?
So two things. First, I have to say although you're quite right about the history of this, and God knows Bill Perry and others were very frustrated by the unwillingness of the PLA to respond. I took away, despite the very interesting tone of the exchanges during Secretary Hagel's most recent trip, a new willingness by the PLA actually to begin to include some of these issues in the dialogue between our military and theirs. And clearly, to convince the PLA, it's going to have to be in conversations between our military and their military. I think that's indispensable. But the second thing is to be quite candid, which is to say, look, there are two choices here. Either we go down this path in which we begin to develop reciprocal restraint and transparency, or we will have a competition. And as Mike has said very powerfully, that's a competition that the PLA doesn't necessarily win, right? We have tremendous assets on our side, and this is where the resolve comes in. We have to make clear that there are two paths. There's the path of beginning to take these confidence-building measures and reciprocity and transparency, or there's the path of out-and-out competition, and that we are prepared for that, and we will undertake it, both in terms of our commitments and our capabilities, because as you pointed out throughout this, what makes the credibility and the attractiveness of the reassurance route so strong is the recognition that there's nothing to be gained by going down the other route. And obviously, that if there's any assumption in the book, it's that if we set our mind to it, the United States is more than able to be successful in this competition with the PLA. We shouldn't want it. Everybody loses. It's costly. It's destabilizing. But if it's a choice that each side has to make, and I think it's what we hope would happen is that we would put this bluntly to each other, which is here's a way to restrain the arms race, to create greater crisis stability, or there's this other way. And we think it's a win-win to move in the direction we're doing that doesn't require either side to trust the other or to, you know, assume benevolence on the other side, but still allows us to have security at a much more stable and less cost.
Let's talk about allies for a minute. A number of your recommendations, for example, which I agree with, by the way, on the Korean Peninsula, work towards trying to have some exchanges with our Chinese counterparts on scenarios for instability, for what unification would look like. Even if we aren't getting much of an answer, it's probably useful for us to describe some of our objectives. But right away, you get into trouble if you do that without our Korean allies. Or when you talk about missile defense, you recommend that we have, as I understand it, a declaratory policy that we would not seek to defeat Chinese ballistic missiles with our national missile defense. But then right away you get into this question that will concern the Japanese in particular about whether we're accepting mutually assured destruction, which is mostly words, but it matters in terms of the credibility of our extended deterrence. So how do you bring allies into this confidence-building process? A lot of the dangerous incidents at sea, but especially in the air, are not U.S. Air Force F-15s, they're Japanese F-15s and Chinese unmanned aerial vehicles or jets. So how do you bring our allies into this as part of this reassurance exercise with the Chinese, and how do you reassure our allies as you do it?
Right, obviously, the presence of allies makes this more complicated. Part of it is, on the resolve side, is to make clear to our allies where our bottom lines and red lines are and how those take into account their interest. Because I think that for them, that in the end, that will be the most important. And so the decision to reiterate the commitment under Article 5 and the Senkaku seems to me as part of resolve here that is both resolve vis-a-vis China and reassurance vis-a-vis Japan. And it's also the case that in each of these things, one has to be very conscious of that. I think one of the things that we do talk about is in terms of where U.S. red lines ought to be, is it's clearly been an objective of China for some time to see the end of our security alliances, our formal security alliances in East Asia, and we very strongly come out against that. We think that it's still something that we ought to make clear is not on the table, and whatever if that's what China seeks reassurance on by a commitment by the United States to move away from those things, I think we should decline that. We should say some things we can't reassure you because we believe it's in our interest, our allies' interest, and by the way, in your interest. And I think we do have an obligation in any of these areas to begin to discuss these things with our allies first. And so, and even with our friends and non-formal allies, just as we've always said, for example, vis-a-vis Taiwan, that we would not negotiate matters that directly affect the security of Taiwan over or outside Taiwan's engagement. I think that is critically a part of what we do. But the other side of it is that our allies have an interest in our managing this relationship. They want to be reassured about our commitment, but I don't think there's anybody, or very few anyway, in East Asia who wants to see a conflict between the United States and China. And so for our allies, the best of all worlds are one in which our security presence is maintained, our commitments are maintained, but we still manage to manage the competition between the United States and China.
Just add two things, if I could, quickly. One, for example, on Korea, contingency planning. The way I would put it, I hope it's not too starkly for how you would put it, Jim, is there can't be any conversation that's just the U.S. and China. We have only one military type of presence in Korea. It's Combined Forces Command with our Republic of Korea allies. Any kind of contingency planning has to be done through that vehicle. Sure, you can have side conversations at cocktail parties that, you know, allude to the desirability of the conversation in the abstract between an American and a Chinese official who meet, or academics or whomever. But the real thinking about how you would anticipate certain scenarios, it has to be done with our ally, clearly, in that case, specifically South Korea. On incidents at sea, as you know, we had a U.S.-Soviet pact in the Cold War on avoiding overly dangerous or provocative or inadvertently dangerous behavior when ships operated near each other for purposes of reconnaissance. We favor something like that. We argue for it in the book. People will say, no, it's not worth it in the U.S.-China context because there are all these different arms of the Chinese state that are out there on the waters. Well, I would say, let's include them and let's include American allies. And maybe you don't get to that finish line right away, but that should be the goal, because you have to involve everybody for the reasons you mentioned.
Let me ask you another alliance question, because you're losing your voice and you sound like Rich Armitage. So you're in the zone. Sound like Rich Armitage. Pushing the allies thing, you know, one of the sort of principles of deterrence is, you know, you when the other side's growing in its capabilities, you can asymmetrically target their vulnerabilities, which is what the version of air-sea battle you don't like includes. And you've sort of said we need to be careful about that. Then the other thing you could do is to horizontally build your partnerships, jointness, and combined capabilities with allies, which we're doing, with Japan with the Defense Guidelines Review, with the Philippines with this new access agreement, and they're doing with each other, India and Japan, Australia, Japan, Vietnam, Philippines, all with Japan and each other. But the Chinese think that's containment. When you look at the map and the lights start, you know, blinking from Japan around India, that looks like containment. So what do you think about the role of allies in terms of deterrence, dissuasion? Jim made the point, completely agree, we need to disabuse our friends in Beijing of thinking we're going to be done with alliances. That's fundamental to the stability landscape of the region. But alliances, there are alliances and then there are alliances. So should we be careful about how we build our security partnerships with countries, with allies like the Philippines or partners like Vietnam? Should we be careful about Defense Guidelines Review with Japan, collective self-defense? Should we be encouraging that to maintain a stable resolve? Or is this an area also where we need to think about reassurance?
And here you're asking the academic defense scholar, when we have two of the country's best diplomats on this very topic, so I'll be brief and then hope I can be corrected by you two for anything I get wrong. But I would first of all say that it depends on the country what should be the next step. And for example, with Vietnam, I think it would be wonderful to start doing some more peace operations with Vietnam and with China. In other words, we should look for opportunities where, whether you call it air-sea operations or some other broad rubric, you can try to foster military-to-military cooperation in areas that we've seen with the Gulf of Aden counter-piracy mission with the U.S. and China already. We could imagine the next step. It's one of the reasons, don't blame Jim for this, but it's one of the reasons why I actually want to see U.S. Forces in Congo in the U.N. peacekeeping mission, because there's an opportunity there. But that's not the main reason why I would do it, don't worry. And I'm not going to suggest that's in the book. But more generally, humanitarian assistance is very much in the book, and it is on PACOM's agenda, as you know, and it's something where the U.S. and China have an enormous shared interest. I mean, we've seen these terrible tragedies in East Asia in the last decade, some of which each of you has had to help our allies deal with, and other countries as well, like Indonesia. We've got to be ready potentially for even bigger things. We haven't yet seen the logical extreme of where these tragedies could necessarily go, and you're going to need the capacity of big navies and big armies potentially to help with things that could be a factor of 10 bigger than the Philippines typhoon or the Japanese tsunami, in theory. And so that's one more area where I would look. I realize I'm getting a little bit astray because you're probably more thinking about Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Philippines. And again, it's got to be case by case. One thing we say in the book And here I'll just tee up the issue. Jim's probably going to want to say more on the Senkaku Diaoyu Island dispute. We try to develop a range of possible options. In this book, we can't say and shouldn't say that if there were an unprovoked Chinese seizure of one of the islands overnight, tonight, that the American-Japanese response should be X, Y, or Z. We don't try to say that. What we do say is, here's a range of tools, and depending on the circumstance, you may want a more indirect approach or a more direct approach. And I think that's the appropriate level of generality to keep this at for the moment.
My short answer to your question is, yes, we should do it, but it's important how we do it. So having these relationships both in the hub and spoke and between the spokes, I think it's all to the good. But again, going back to our experience with Taiwan, I think we've learned some ways of doing these things. And so I think it has been sensible under the TRA that we have tried to identify a set of capabilities that we could provide to or work with Taiwan on that are defensive. Understand that nothing is purely defensive, but some systems are more destabilizing than others. And I think it's been smart that we have not given Taiwan long-range surface-to-surface missiles that could attack the mainland and deep into China. That would be destabilizing. And the forces that we have focused on, air defense, missile defense and the like, are the things we should do. So similarly, as we engage with our allies and they with each other, we need to think about how we strengthen our capabilities to resist incursions, to resist aggression, whether it's with Japan or the Philippines or Australia, as we're doing now, but to do it in ways that can address what might be the anxieties about China, to again undercut this narrative about the rebalance being a threat to China. And I think it is possible. It's not, you're never going to fully dispel the concerns, but I think if you're transparent about what you're doing, if you're engaged in a dialogue and explaining to the Chinese side why you're doing it while you're doing it, and sensitive to the choices that you can make. What are the capabilities? Why are you placing them there? How does it fit into a strategy which stabilizes the region, that provides reassurance and security to our friends without unnecessarily creating a sense of threat on Chinese side? You're never going to, the one important message of this book is this is not a problem that can be solved. It's a constant dynamic tending to, which will always require a lot of management and will always be both sides having a certain amount of doubt about the other's intentions. But the more deliberate and more explicit we are about this, the greater chances are that we'll manage this inevitable competition in ways that both avoid a very damaging and costly arms race and, should a crisis emerge, reduce the chance that we will create a conflict where and lose the chance to de-escalate the crisis.
You and I have had this discussion separately, but the allies get a vote and the allies hedge too. And that can be a process that can be as destabilizing as us hedging. And so it makes a lot of sense to be more joint and to be reassuring to the allies and to have dissuasion and deterrence be credible to them. I think that's an important corollary to the thesis.
And ought to be an important corollary for China as well.
Yep.
And I think, as you know, it's an argument we've been making, both of us together and separately for a long time, that part of the persuasiveness of this approach is to try to get each side to think about what the alternatives are. And if we don't do something like this, exactly as you say, and we've seen this in the debate about Japan. And so I think that, the key here, and I'm happy, again, I'm not in this one speaking necessarily for Mike, I think we have slight difference of focus on this one, that I'm quite comfortable should the Japanese people choose to move to a more traditional definition of collective self-defense, because I think that fits better into this kind of structure that we're talking about. But as Japan moves in this direction, it will be equally important for Japan to be clear about what the limits are and to provide some reassurance about how, as it moves in this direction, as I think its advocates sensibly say, how this will increase stability in the region and not create more instability.
Right, agreed. Why don't we take some questions?
Can I say one thing for you? Because I see my good friend Nick Lardy here. And I want to say one more thing about the book. The one thing that you will notice if you look at the book is we don't talk a lot about economics in the book. And I want to just say why we don't talk a lot about economics in the book. Not that it's not important. It's enormously important. While we've talked a little here about the fact that some look to economic interdependence as a source of stability, it's also true that economics is a source of friction in the relationship. There are two reasons why we don't focus on it. First, neither of us are economists, and Nick can write the next book. But second, it's our belief that under the best of circumstances, the knitting together effects of economic interdependence will not be successful in preventing conflict if the security side isn't addressed. And under the worst of circumstances, no matter how bad the economic conflict, if we manage the security differences, those economic differences can be handled. And so this may just reflect the fact that we're both kind of security guys. But I think the motivation was to say that this is a necessary, not a sufficient condition, but a necessary condition to maintaining long-term stability in the relationship, not at all to diminish the importance of all these other factors. And indeed, you know, ideally, if we're successful and this strategy is adopted and works, it actually opens up the playing field for more cooperative work together on issues that are of common concern, whether it's environment or public health or all the other things that we should be working together on and which there aren't the same kind of inherent tensions.
It does. It's just the economics and security are always different, but it does cause me to think about my experience in the NSC, probably your experience in the NSC, which is when you have an NSC meeting and you're talking about these security issues, who's at the table? The Treasury Department. And maybe one of the confidence-building measures we need to encourage is that the Central Military Commission needs some economic representatives so that when you're talking about the little war you're thinking about, somebody can point out how much it will cost and what it will do to your markets. All right, let's take some questions. You mind if I call on
please,
people?
Please.
Right, and you have microphones, so right here in the front.
Thanks very much. And thank you, Jim and Mike, for a classically great discussion. You speak early in the book about four factors, national security narrative and the strategic culture. I won't redefine those for people, but here's the question that I have. And it has to do with the third component, which is domestic politics. I'll address the question to Jim, but I'm interested in your, both your reactions. You've sat in three of the major chairs, running policy planning, deputy at state, deputy at NSC. And the question I have is, given the message of the book, as I understand it, I'm about a third of the way through it, this is something that we need to be at. We need to be at it consistently. We need to be at it over time. This is long-range thinking, et cetera. Given our domestic politics and given the fact that so much foreign policy is really driven by the president and his or her national security advisor and team, what are the practical possibilities of achieving what I think you outline in the book in a political system that seems to me has significant sort of speed bumps in the way? And given that you've been there in two different administrations, I'd be interested in your take on that.
Thanks, Gary. I think for me, one of the reasons why this is such an attractive approach is precisely because it's a way to get a handle on both sides in the domestic politics. Because part of what drives the domestic politics is when, I'll say, do it looking from the U.S. side towards China, but the same would be true looking in the other direction. When the Chinese do something which looks provocative from an American point of view, whether it's developing a new anti-ship ballistic missile, or whether it's testing an ASAT, or whether it's expanding its patrols and its military operations in the South China Sea, it triggers a domestic debate about what's China up to and how are you responding to that. And these provocative or apparently provocative things stimulate in the domestic milieu a desire to respond to that and creates this downward spiral that causes the relationships as each mirror images the other. Conversely, if each side, let's start with the Chinese side, takes steps of reassurance, of restraint, of transparency that show a moving away from ambiguous or aggressive-looking behavior, it changes the dynamic domestically. It allows a president to say, look, here's a case where they backed off from doing something that we said was worrisome to us, or they've done something that is reassuring for us. That allows you to engage the domestic population, the polity in the United States, to say, here's something concrete that's going on that would lead us to believe that it's worth continuing to take steps to try to improve the relationship. It's the absence of these concrete steps by each side that's leading the skeptical voices in each society to say, look, these guys are bad, dangerous, aggressive, threatening. And we need to be able to break that cycle, not just as this quiet discussion between leaders, but between the publics in both sides. We need to do things, I think, that help Chinese leaders credibly say, oh, the rebalance is not designed to contain. And they need to do things that say that our rise is not designed to kick the United States out past the first island chain or out of the Western Pacific entirely. The more each side does concrete things, the more credible that becomes in the domestic political debate and the more successful the kind of the virtuous cycle becomes.
If I could just add one word. We have to sometimes give ourselves credit as a United States because we say we're strategically impatient. We oscillate back and forth with the partisan ebb and flow in Washington. But U.S.-China policy, partly because of the excellence of practitioners like the two gentlemen I'm privileged to share the stage with, has been, to some extent, at least an exception. Or maybe there's more consensus in foreign policy in general than we like to admit in our partisan debates. But certainly on U.S.-China policy, there was a sense of engagement combined with hedging, that word that we have raised with some concern today. The problem is that times are changing and that hedging is getting to be either more difficult or more potentially dangerous than it was before, because sustaining American outright supremacy, not just superiority, but complete dominance of the littoral and maritime areas of the Asia Pacific is harder than it was before. So, two things. We can do pretty well with continuity, but the old formula isn't necessarily going to be the one that gets us there. We're going to have to rethink the basics to have a path going forward.
You've inspired me to ask you a question. What's good enough? If primacy in the first island chain in the Western Pacific isn't good enough anymore, what is it? Is it denial? Is it what can we live with in terms of our strategic position in the Western Pacific? Is there a line below? You know, at some point you can reassure, you can avoid conflict, but if suddenly you've lost something that's really a vital national interest, then you need to rethink the strategy. I'm wondering what that is.
It's a really hard question, so yes. I'm glad Jim can correct what I get
final,
wrong.
Final exam question for my Georgetown students.
They're all suffering right now. Are any of them here right now?
No, they're all home trying
tomorrow.
To. No, those are questions, not students.
I would like, as an American, but the book was, remember, written with the idea that we're developing a concept that can be applicable for both countries, we hope, but it still was written by two Americans. As an American, but also as a strategist, I would like the shifts in power to be gradual. And I don't think we can sustain the kind of supremacy we had before. I can't really give a direct answer to the question you posed. If I saw a meaningful distinction between $600 billion and $800 billion in the U.S. budget in terms of the invulnerability of our bases or the inherent ability to win any and all scenarios against China, I would have to think hard about, you know, the answer. But I'm not good enough at defense analysis. My students in defense analysis know that defense analytical tools are often not good enough to give a sufficiently precise answer to your question. So the only thing I can feel fairly comfortable about saying with confidence is I want the changes to be gradual. I want to give allies and neutrals a sense of reassurance, give China a chance to feel out what it means, what it's trying to accomplish. You guys may feel differently. I don't know that the Chinese even have a clear sense of what they want to accomplish with their newfound power. They want greater strategic space and influence. I'd like to give them time through our policy of reassurance and resolve to find a relatively benign way to achieve that. And the one thing I'm confident of is it's going to take time and it's going to be easier if there's no sense of imminent American decline combined with astronomical and rapid Chinese rise. So that's what I'm most concerned about is the pace of change.
I just go at it, I completely agree with that, but in a more kind of near-term way of thinking about this, is I want to see us develop a set of tools and approach which allows us to respond to actions which cross our red line without having to move rapidly and quickly up the escalatory chain so that we can impose costs that are meaningful and will cause the other side to reconsider its decisions and provide an off-ramp while reserving the right, if that doesn't work, to move up the escalatory chain. But I think that what most worries me is that on both sides, particularly because of the asymmetric capabilities and because of these new technologies, that we are in danger of having a small crisis turn into an all-out conflict very early because we don't have the tools to sustain deterrence on the one hand without proposing a strategic threat to the other side.
And maybe, I don't see any students in the audience, so maybe part of the answer is it's not about where you draw the line as we traditionally did strategy. It's about geographically, but it's about not allowing an environment where coercion works.
Exactly.
Yeah, which, and you give us, you describe a toolkit that's not just military, it's much broader and allows you to escape the escalation. Yeah. Did I see Bob Einhorn back there? He took off. He had his hand up. Yeah, Bob?
Rob Warren, thank you for a very interesting discussion. I look forward to reading the book. I would like to get your comments that it seems to me China's been clumsy in the last several years. It's alienated, or at least put on the edge, a lot of countries in East Asia, perhaps unnecessarily so. Thus, perhaps things are not quite as serious as far as the response. And you might comment on the president's recent trip to four East Asian countries, which seemed to go well. They welcomed it, and I think they're deeply concerned about China's future and activities.
You know, it is striking because after roughly a decade, from beginning around 2000 till around 2007, 2008, we were all talking about how skillful China was at soft power and, you know, memories of Hu Jintao's visit to Australia where he spoke to the parliament to rapturous applause. And then all of a sudden, things kind of got pretty scratchy around 2008, 2009. Again, because part of our premise is you can't really know why they decided anything. It's hard to know for sure. But I think, if I had to guess, and this is just me speaking personally, I think that the financial crisis of 2008, 2009 led some people in Beijing to draw a conclusion that the United States had hit a crest and was facing a near-term serious decline, and that the balance of power was shifting very rapidly, that China had been relatively immune to this, the United States was badly weakened by this. And I think there was a bit of hubris on the Chinese side. My sense is, for all the reasons you said, and then following that, the actions in the South China Sea, at the Hanoi ARF, you know, where they just seemed to be quite pushy. But the reaction back and the fact that they saw a classic balancing taking place, I think, has caused some rethink on the Chinese side, which is good because I think it then opens the opportunity as they now have some more realistic understanding that just mouthing the words of peaceful rise is not going to be reassuring in the face of actions and the development of capabilities which are at best ambiguous and at worst seem quite threatening to others. That, I think, allows this message of their need to reassure and to take concrete steps to have more traction.
But our Chinese friends blame it on us. So how do we convince our friends in Beijing that we're reacting?
No, but that's the point. It's that so much of the dialogue, as you know, is that each side says, oh, we're just reacting to the other. That's what the hedging problem is all about. What we basically have to say is, time out. You'll believe you're totally defensible, you're virtuous, and this is the point, Gary, about the competing strategic narratives. Each side deeply believes in their own strategic narrative, which sees themselves as a benign hegemon, right? We are absolutely the benignest of all hegemons ever. Just ask any American. We mean no harm to anybody. We produce global public goods. The world is a safer, better place for our being the dominant power. But I think if you scratch the surface of most Chinese, and now not even the surface, if you read Xi Jinping's China Dream, he says, look, when we were powerful, the world was peaceful and safe, and the Ming era, and yes, people were, you know, tributary states, but we never asked much of them. All they had to do was bow low, and then everything would be fine. We never imposed our will. Admiral Zheng He traveled around the world and never conquered anybody. We just have to accept that each believes themselves to be benign and the other potentially hostile, and just move on from there and just understand that we're never going to reconcile these two narratives, but there are things that we can do that don't require us to believe in the other guy's story and still stabilize the relationship.
Yes, sir.
Hi. Yeah, I just come back from a month's holiday in China, so I saw that the dialogue on both sides are bypassing each other. It means everyone telling his own stories. You know, I have a question about the word. I mean, is hedging the right word? Because if you define hedging, it seems to me you feel sort of containment element in it. So is that right? So which means holding China down or, you know, keeping U.S. supremacy. And is that right? I mean, you said, you know, both would see the incentive not having the arms race, but do you think those military industry or even the Pentagon believe that? Because I remember back in 1993 when I visited Camp Smith, they already talk about China's threat in South China Sea here, there. So the military are great at justifying threats everywhere, so they could have a great budget. Thank you.
Well, all militaries do that, and it's understandable that they do that. But that's the most. If there's one important idea in the book above all, which is one that seems a bit counterintuitive, as Mike said early on, is that hedging seems just, well, of course we're going to hedge. I mean, that's what you all do, right? Rainy day, put away a little money, you know, all that stuff. But the problem with hedging in strategic relationships is it can be self-fulfilling in the worst sense. And so you have to find a way to respond to the instinct of hedging, which is to be prepared for uncertainty and unknowability without triggering what the IR people call a security dilemma. And that is the core motivation of the book. Is there a way to get the benefits that are ascribed to hedging without triggering the security dilemma and this downward spiral? And that's what we immodestly feel we've begun to try to crack, is an approach that does that, that doesn't create the bad sides of hedging, but also doesn't leave you imprudently and naively trusting these assurances of the other side, because that's equally unsatisfactory. And so that, I think, is the core strategy here, is to recognize that that if you can find a way out of this dilemma between naive trust on the one hand and counterproductive hedging on the other hand, you have a better chance at managing a relationship which is inherently competitive and inherently uncertain as to what the intentions are on the long-term side, but still can be stabilized. And that, you know, it's an ambitious goal, but I think that's what's motivated the writing of the book.
Let's put it one more way. There are interpretations of the word hedging that we could probably live with. The problem is that it's become identified with a certain way of thinking for a long time about American policy towards Asia, which is maintain whatever level of military preeminence and supremacy we require in order to make sure that in the broader maritime domain of the Pacific, we can essentially have our way. The problem is that's just gotten to the point where it's not sustainable at the same level of technological robustness. We still favor maintaining American presence and strength throughout the region, but we don't think that, or at least I don't think that quite the same level of dominance is going to be achievable based on trends in technology and power. So if hedging means, okay, you have a few more ways to repair your runways so that when they get attacked by the other side, you can fill in the holes more quickly, I don't have any particular problem with that definition.
Part of the reason I resist, because I think Mike's exactly right. But we talk about resilience, you know, which is the idea here, which is ways to make it so that you're not forced to escalate quickly and preemptively. Resilience is a very powerful tool here because it allows you to the space and time to respond prudently and ways that allow you to both be effective but to de-escalate in ways if you don't have resilience. So, I mean, part of the, you know, you remember the good old days of the Soviet Union and the window of vulnerability and all that stuff. People were nervous because there was just this sense that there was this abstract possibility of a bolt out of the blue or an action that the other side could take that would render you hopeless and paralyzed and having to cry uncle before you could respond. And that, I mean, again, I stay away from the age where I just don't like it, but you definitely want to avoid being in that position because it gives you more options. It gives you a range of possibilities in terms, and the beauty of that is that that is far less threatening to the other side. It is some threat. If you can survive, then you're obviously surviving to fight the next day, but it doesn't require you to respond preemptively or early in a crisis. You don't need to launch on warning. You don't need to do the things that where you have no time. And in a world of instantaneous and nanosecond threats like cyber, this is a big concern because if you perceived yourself under a massive cyber attack that was going to knock out your command and control, you'd have to respond, right? And you'd have to respond in ways that would probably be pretty aggressive. So what we're trying to get at is how do you develop those responses and tools that allow you to respond effectively but not before you've been able to think through the range of options.
So when you use words engaging and hedging implies to a lot of people, I think, a kind of almost passive keeping your powder dry. So in the cyber world, hedging might be interpreted as meaning if you're worried about cyber attacks, you prepare a counteroffensive capability in cyber. But really, reading the book, what you're also talking about is shaping. So you're not just sort of passively, when there are things that are problematic, you you use dissuasion and you make it clear that it's going to not be worth the effort. When there are things, areas for reassurance, you described it earlier as very dynamic. And this requires a lot of effort from the U.S. government. It does not allow you to, you know, as Lee Kuan Yew likes to say, pretend that international relations is a DVD you can turn off or turn off Asia while you go deal with Korea. You're talking about a very active level of involvement from the principals because it's so dynamic. You're not just storing chestnuts for the winter.
Absolutely. Right? And it's, I mean, it is, but, you know, the stakes are so big that if you ask yourself, what would you want people to invest in? You know, this is the thing you would want them to invest in. This is, you know, there are other things. I mean, if you think about the long-run big threats, many of them are not state-to-state at all. It's, you know, global public health, disease, things like that, which I would also like to see, climate change. But in terms of the kind of traditional international relations, the state-to-state management, this is the big enchilada. This is the story that I think will broadly shape certainly the security in the region and perhaps more broadly to come. And so if there's one place you want to have that kind of hands-on management and have each side in this dynamic. And the good news is, you know, we've begun to set up these structures in U.S.-China relations. The problem is we haven't endowed them with the content yet that they need.
Yes, in the back. You get a microphone, sir. Yeah.
A simple question. In America, we believe in the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, all that. To this day, call me naive, what do they believe in? The Chinese, what do they believe in? I mean, I see, like, they're more capitalist than we are. Very raw capitalism, and then you have a Communist Party that basically is about control. What do those people believe in? Their value system.
Let me add on to the question by asking, you know, past efforts at detente with the Soviets in the Cold War, or at moving, for example, from Nixon's visit towards normalization, in the past, these efforts to create the kind of reassurance and stability that you're talking about have often been undone by values issues, by human rights, by democracy, by, and you can imagine questions in Tibet, Xinjiang, and regime type or these sorts of issues being an uncertainty. Is there a way to make this process more effective by, for example, incorporating Congress more or sustaining a dialogue, or we have a dialogue, it's not very sustained, on human rights? I mean, how do you, that's always a factor in U.S.-China relations. And it's kind of a wild card. Is there a way to incorporate that in the strategy?
Right, you're right. And it does make it hard to develop, you know, support for things that seem to be positive in the relationship. But I would observe that, you know, if you think about it, that even at the height of the debate over Helsinki in U.S.-Soviet relations and the very strong opposition of Senator Jackson and others because of human rights-related things, is that ultimately nobody tore apart the strategic fabric. And the important thing to observe from a historical point of view is that after the mid-1960s, and notwithstanding the worries about nuclear winter and the like, there really was never another crisis that where the United States and the Soviet Union were on the brink of nuclear exchange. And part of the reason was because of the engagement between our two militaries and the beginning of a structure of strategic understandings. First the ABM Treaty, then the offensive limitations, then the conventional forces in Europe agreements, which bounded the competition. And we still, horrible human rights, values, things, correctly. I mean, these were fundamental differences between our two societies. But it was actually easier to have those differences in a context where you had at least the sense that it was not going to then translate into all-out nuclear war. And so part of what we have to understand is we are never going to be on the same page as the Chinese, and we're never going to be indifferent to China's indifference to human rights as we understand it. But we have to find a way to have those disagreements without that becoming a source that then becomes part of conflict. So part of the way to get to the domestic political thing is actually to be perfectly free to be as critical as you want about China's human rights record as long as you take the steps you need to stabilize the security dynamic. And I think the two actually, in some ways, allow more space for that very honest discussion about our concerns about the Chinese political system.
I think part of the difficulties of U.S.-China relations in the 70s was that Beijing assumed they were, because Jackson Vanik never went at the Chinese side, it only went at the Soviet. So I take from what you're saying that for this to work, our counterparts in Beijing need to understand this will be a perennial part of what America
Absolutely.
Considers a
Absolutely.
National interest, not just a value, but an interest that we're going to pursue constructively but candidly.
But I mean, but to be clear, it's also the case that we are also not going to launch a war to change the regime.
Right.
I mean, that's where the break line is.
Right. I'll just add one very brief thing on this, which almost goes without saying, but I think it's still worth saying, which is even though we should and can keep up the pressure on China on human rights issues, what China's accomplished in the last 40 years is extraordinary by at least my definition of human rights. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Congo. Thank God for the Chinese, they don't have the fate that the Congolese people have had by no economic development, no right to even keeping their children alive. The Chinese state has made incredible progress in building up an educational and healthcare system that's brought more people out of poverty than any nation before in history. I think we should not be afraid to say that once in a while, even though we should also keep up the pressure that they can and should do a lot better.
500 million people brought out of poverty in the last 3.5 decades. And part of that was the relationship with the U.S. They were inseparable. So we have a dog in this fight, so to speak.
Well said.
Yeah, sir, in the halfway up the middle row.
Thank you very much. Peter Michael Nielsen, Danish Embassy. There's quite a lot of discussion in town right now about our coming out of the Ukraine crisis, whether sort of Russia will be pushed more towards China, or what sort of relationship will form between Russia and China. Is this something that you have been considered as writing your book, or what is your opinion on that?
It's not something we talk about specifically in the book. I think that there are obviously some areas in which China and Russia's interests coincide and others where they have differences. I think what we've seen over the last 6 or 7 years as some of these abstract notions that people, many of whom know nothing about political relations, about alignments between two countries that sort of seem like they make for a good book title, don't turn out to be that clear. I think the Chinese certainly will take advantage of opportunities to work with Russia where they think it's in their interest. I think it is certainly, there's no accident that Xi Jinping chose to go to Moscow on his first trip abroad. But I don't think this represents a fundamental alignment between the two. They have many differences, many different perspectives. And the one thing I think is clear is that other things being equal, there's a powerful sense, as Mike just suggested, in China that their dominant priority right now, which is continued economic development of the country, requires peace and stability and a good relationship with the United States because they certainly can't sustain economic growth or even maintain what they have in the face of a dramatic disruption of U.S.-China relations, not to mention an out-and-out conflict. So I think there's a stabilizer there that would prevent kind of a strategic realignment between Russia and China. And you see this even in their reaction to Ukraine, which has been lukewarm. I know many of us here would have liked them to be even more critical of what Russia did and think that it would be in China's interest to be more critical. But there's certainly been no, you know, standing and patting them on the back in Beijing.
Yeah, yes, sir, in the back, right there.
Thank you very much. I just have a question about, your European allies. I mean, you talked a lot about the situation of your Asian allies and how they should deal with U.S.-China relations, but I think you kind of left out the EU, which is also a very important power block in this constellation, so I just wanted to ask your opinions about what the EU can do to kind of stabilize the relationship, kind of, act as an honest broker or something like that between the U.S. and China. Thank you.
Do you want the EU as an honest broker between the U.S. and China?
No, thanks.
But you do have a role for the EU.
I do have a role for the EU. But I would be stunned if most EU countries wanted to be an honest broker in this relationship. First of all, we are allies. And it would be an odd situation for the EU to be in. I think, to be honest, and I've said this in many EU forums, I'm part of many dialogues, U.S., Europe, China dialogues, I think the most important thing, frankly, is for the EU to take a more strategic approach to East Asia. I've had a chance to talk to Lady Ashton a lot about this, and I think she shares the view. But I think that regrettably, but understandably, because of the distance, that there's not the same sense of this strategic problem in Europe that the United States and its East Asian allies face. China's not a military threat to Europe. Europe's and Europe is an enormously important economic partner of China. And you'll recall, and I know my European friends in the audience will recall, the somewhat contentious debates we had a few years ago about the arms embargo and the debate in the EU about whether to lift the arms embargo, the Tiananmen-related arms embargo on China. you can play a very important role if the EU is prepared to understand why this security dilemma is emerging in East Asia and to be part of helping to send the message to China about why it's in its interest to address the security dilemma rather than to rely on everybody's economic dependence on China to kind of bring them around to their side. I know many in the EU understand that, but I think it would be even better if this were a more explicit part of the European strategy and a more explicit engagement between senior officials in the EU and the United States and with East Asians to take that broader perspective.
Mike, did you?
Yes.
Thank you for doing this. My name is Dong Huiyu with China Review News Agency. When making the speech in CSIS last week, the Assistant Secretary Danny Russo said the U.S. is not locked into the unchanged status quo in Asia-Pacific, and the U.S. welcomes China to participate in the discussion of the rules in this area. And we do see in economic area, China was accepted by the WTO and having a more voting power in IMF and the World Bank. But in the security area, we didn't see a lot of actions. So my question for you is, could it be possible that a more inclusive security framework in the Asia-Pacific area that could accommodate a rise in China be established in the Asia-Pacific area? Thank you.
You know, I think I would have put it differently because I think the United States has welcomed a more inclusive framework, including mechanisms like the ASEAN Regional Forum and the like, and that it's been China that's been reluctant to engage in multilateral discussions of security, the code of conduct in the South China Sea and the like. So I don't speak for the administration, but I think generally it has been the view of many in the United States that this would be very important to have, in addition to the bilateral alliances, which we value, a broader framework through the ARF, through the East Asia Summit and the like, and that it would be good for China and everybody to have this multilateral framework because it would ease some of the tensions that exclusively bilateral dealings have. I don't know, what do you think, Eric?
No, very, very fair, and that's why we also underscore we should be looking for areas of military cooperation. So air-sea operations is partly designed just to be a broader construct than air-sea battle. We still have to do contingency planning the old-fashioned way as one element of our military policy going forward with just close allies, but we need to look for opportunities to collaborate more with neutrals, including China. And so that's why I mentioned before humanitarian assistance, peace operations, not just as easy throwaway lines, because we all say this, you know, it's the benign liberal agenda, but I'm trying to give some specificity. For example, imagine a humanitarian disaster 10 times worse than anything we've seen. That can happen. We are so populous on this planet now as a species. We have such an acute dependence on infrastructure working. There can be a lot of things that are very, very serious and could put more lives at risk than any dispute over, you know, at least localized dispute over the Senkaku Islands or Diaoyu Islands. And so we should be thinking about these problems as serious problems and areas for cooperation.
Last question for me, having solved this problem, what's the next book? I know you've always got a next book.
I'm going to work on the future of land warfare, and I hope very much that U.S.-China scenarios are not part of it. I will be wondering about whether Russia-China scenarios can be discarded from, because the idea is to think about where does large-scale violence on land, whether interstate or intrastate, potentially have a future as we look towards thinking about how to size the future U.S. Army and Marine Corps.
It probably won't surprise you, Mike, but I've been troubled by so much of the recent discourse about this assumption slash critique that the United States is incapable of developing and executing grand strategy. And, you know, I think it's partially, you know, I want to spend some time writing about what the elements of that would be, but more importantly is what it would take to be able to be successful at that. How do you both accept the institutional limitations that we have, which we have, and they're actually, many of them are strengths, a pluralistic democratic system, alternates of governance and stuff like that, and still think about how a democratic society like ours can have enough you know, sustained and coherent strategy to be effective in this very complicated world, to be able to execute things like this.
De Tocqueville said democracies are incapable of strategy. Trotsky said, well, you may not care about strategy, but strategy cares about you. I think Trotsky probably got it right. There's despite our dysfunctionality, any major nation state does some kind of grand strategy. Maybe the way we all dance at parties, it may not be pretty, but it's discernible to everyone else in the system, so it's worth thinking through. Excellent projects. I look forward to seeing you in 6 months to talk about them both. Okay. Thank you and congratulations.
Thank you all.